Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to a worm's eye view with Rear Admiral Davidson, who was Flag Officer Commanding East Australia Area Naval Operations in the Indian Ocean 1944 to 1945. It was recorded on the 3rd of March 1978 and duration is 54 minutes.
Mr. President, members of the Naval Historical Society, ladies and gentlemen, and distinguished guests, it is a very great honour to be invited to address you, and I was somewhat shaken to find I'm the ninth admiral to have done so, and I hope very few of you have listened to the other eight so that you'll be unable to draw invidious comparisons. And I do in fact approach the task with considerable trepidation, because speaking on an historical subject with authority requires a very great deal of research. The discovery of one insignificant error destroys credibility somewhat completely. For instance, when I was refreshing my memory of events that are a period I'm about to speak about, I looked, of course, to that definitive work on World War II sea operations, The War at Sea, by Stephen Roskill. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. And found that he had made a minor error, or my memory had made a minor error, and my whole world started to tremble. So I do not therefore present my talk to you as a fully researched and comprehensive document. Should some error of mine clash with the better knowledge or memory of any one of you, I hope that this may be a matter of friendly discussion at the end, and I crave no rotten fruit or missiles while I speak. Naval operations in the Indian Ocean, 1944 to 1945, a worm's eye view. There was a slight misprint, by the way, in the proceedings. You probably noticed it said 1942, but this worm wasn't present at that time, and so I can only speak from personal knowledge from about the beginning of 1944. What I have to say stems for the most part from personal memory, a worm's memory and a worm's eye view. By definition, worms go upon their bellies and their view is very limited. If you find what I say somewhat lacking in perspective, then please remember I do not set it up as history, but I think that the view from the bottom can be a salutary lesson to some of us who have risen higher than the bottom to remember what it was like to be down, certainly at the bottom of the officer corps. It probably hasn't escaped you that when I say worm, I mean midshipman, which was what I was for most of the time during the war. But I'll give you a very short word as to the origins of that worm and his former experience. Apart from difficult details, difficult now, such as having been born in southern Rhodesia, which I leave to discussion with the various immigration authorities around the world. I joined the Royal Navy in 1943 as a special entry cadet at the age of 18, and by September was ready to go to sea, and HMS Sheffield was my first ship, and managed to prove half of that very old adage that war consists of long periods of utter boredom interspersed with short moments of stark terror on my very first day. I joined the ship at 0900 in Plymouth Harbour to find the ship ammunitioning for sailing at 14:30 that day. I was down in the cipher office doing my first watch and actually earning my pay for the first time when at 1500 I had to decipher a signal from the Admiralty addressed particularly to the Sheffield, which was heading for a patrol in the Bay of Biscay, warning us of the likelihood of receiving a German guided bomb from an aircraft, the sort of bomb which had created havoc in the Mediterranean very recently, and giving us some advice as to frequencies which might be tried to jam the bomb. In fact, way back in 1943, electronic countermeasures rearing perhaps one of their first examples in active service. So that was a bit of a shaker to a fellow until that morning didn't even know that radar existed, and that was my first message. At 1600 we went to action stations and found ourselves under attack by six German torpedo bombers, which fortunately didn't get closer to us than the horizon, because our rather late and dilatory Polish fighter escort came in and shot four of them down, scarpering the other two and achieving for our direction officer, who was a sub-lieutenant RNVR, a Distinguished Service Cross for his acumen and rapidity with which he got them onto it. And I thought, boy, what have I joined? This is my first day. Well, of course, it was a further 6 weeks before we fired a shot in anger, and that was a rather routine bombardment sometime after Salerno on the coast of Italy. And that was the sum of experience that I bring to this subject, and you can see that the illumination of it is not going to necessarily be very bright or wide sweeping. I was a paymaster midshipman, it was in those days. I changed to a midshipman S in recent times. The supply designation has been removed from these coat sleeves, and the Navy has come a very long way from when I started, and I find that my horizon has been able to include promotion to flag officer and this very rewarding appointment which I'm trying to fill. Well, I left the Sheffield in December 1943, and the Sheffield left to help sink the Scharnhorst, obviously believing that I didn't need any more shocks. I joined the county cruiser London, and in company with the Cumberland, which was another county cruiser, 8-inch cruiser, those of you who have your copies of Jane's or other reference works will either know it or be able to look it up. Well, rather wonderful ships with a very good range and very good fighting capacity with 8 8-inch guns. We sailed for the Far East Fleet in early February 1944. And although I was inexperienced, I was exceedingly lucky in finding that my action station on the ship was the captain's sight on the bridge. Now, the captain's sight was a pair of binoculars, for those of you who don't remember or don't know, coupled to a gyro, which was coupled to the ship's gyro, and coupled also to the main director and the 4-inch gun directors, and so that from the bridge a target could be indicated to the directors, or they could indicate a query which could be then quickly transmitted to the bridge. In these days of electronics it's all done like that, but in those days we did it with voice pipes and following pointers and that sort of thing. Well, of course, as the moment anything really important happened, I used to get a boot in the bum and ended up against the bulkhead, and the gunnery officer or someone like that would push me out of the way and take over the responsibility. So it was rather fun to be there and see without necessarily being very much blamed for what went on. Well, we arrived in Colombo, and here's my chance to use the pointer, on the western side of Ceylon, of course, now Sri Lanka. And there we were met by the Admiral commanding the fleet, Admiral Sir James Somerville, who had in earlier times commanded Force H, which had fought with such effect at a time when Britain's chances and Britain's fortunes were pretty low. And he had had a rather disappointing time to be sent to the Far East at the time when the Japanese made their one and only strong foray into the Indian Ocean in 1942, when they sank first of all the Dorsetshire and the Cornwall, and shortly after following it with the aircraft carrier Hermes and the destroyer Vampire. Now, I said to you I have not made deep research and I have not gone down every track that I may cross during my talk. I well remember at the time of the first Royal Commission into the sinking of the Voyager, Admiral Beecher, whose secretary I was at the time, coming back from the first encounter with the QC assisting the Royal Commission, Mr. Smythe, who I believe has gone to his maker, and I hope his maker told him a thing or two. But Admiral Beecher was the first witness, and up until his evidence, no one quite understood the sort of savaging that a naval serving officer might receive in such a situation. And during that time, he had been quizzed as to how it could come about that an aircraft reporting this collision, which it had detected from flying above, had given the bearing which indicated that the collision had taken not 10 miles to sea, but 10 miles inland. And the Royal Commission wanted to know from the Admiral commanding the fleet how such an impossible thing could be. And Admiral Beecher said in that bluff and hearty way he had, he was a member of the reciprocal club. And of course then no one laughed and they explored that, and he had to explain that a reciprocal was when someone in a moment of stress gave the reciprocal, that's 180 degrees in the opposite direction of the bearing they really intended. And he came back to lunch that day in the flagship somewhat wounded from this collision with Mr. Smythe, which he hadn't expected and I think he believed he hadn't handled very well. And he explained to me that this reciprocal club throwaway saying he'd used, and which indeed did anger some of our naval aviators, one of whom had used it, of course. And he said, of course, a member of the reciprocal club saved my life, because at the time when the Japanese had just recently sunk the Hermes, the destroyer squadron in which I was serving received a report of an enemy sighting, and we turned onto the course to intercept. And fortunately, he'd given the reciprocal, and so although I knew I was going to my death, I woke up the following morning none the worse for wear. That's just an aside from that time then. But indeed, the fleet had had to retire to Kilindini, which is in East Africa here, leaving virtually the Indian Ocean to whatever the Japanese might like to do. I believe, and later events showed, that the Japanese certainly were not intending to travel in that direction by sea. However, at the time, Admiral Somerville, a great and daunty fighter, had been left with a pretty meagre inventory of ships with which to conduct such operations as he could. And I well remember him saying how much he welcomed ships of the class that we were, with power in the guns, long range, and we didn't have brown paper sides. We did in fact have some armour, not much compared to the battleships, but some. And I remember him complaining particularly about the R-class battleships that he'd been given, the old World War I, pre-World War I battleships, which he said could only steam for about 2 days without having to be given a whole lot of feed water. Apart from worrying about fuel, you had to worry about whether there was enough feed water to cope with the vast distances that he was expected to operate in. Well, logistics have always been a problem, and just to give you an example of that, I'll read you a purported extract from the log of the USS Constitution, dated 1779. I don't vouch for the truth of this, ladies and gentlemen, and if you don't believe it, then you have my sympathy. On the 23rd of August 1779, the USS Constitution set sail from Boston. She left with 475 officers and men, 48,600 gallons of fresh water, 7,400 cannon shot, 11,600 pounds of black powder, and 79,400 gallons of rum. Her mission was to destroy and harass English shipping. Making Jamaica on the 6th of October, she took on 826 pounds of flour and 68,300 gallons of rum. Then she headed for the Azores, arriving there on the 12th of November. She provisioned with 350 pounds of beef and 64,300 gallons of Portuguese wine. On the 18th of November, she set sail for England. In the ensuing days, she defeated five English men of war and captured and scuttled 12 English merchantmen. By the 27th of January, her powder and shot were exhausted. Unarmed, she made a raid on the Firth of Clyde. A landing party captured a whiskey distillery and transferred 40,000 gallons aboard by dawn. And then she headed home. The Constitution arrived in Boston Harbor on the 20th of February in 1780, with no cannon shot, no powder, no food, no rum, no wine, no whiskey, but with 48,600 gallons of stagnant water. Well, that's rather the reverse of the coin which Admiral Somerville suffered with his battleships, because they ran out of water and the Constitution ran out of ammunition. Well, the county-class cruisers were indeed excellent ships, and during the time that I served in the London, we suffered a number of benefits from their ability to go long range without refueling. And they were able to travel from Ceylon down to Fremantle without being refueled, zigzagging and escorting fairly fast troop ships. And that's why I stand here, because on one of those visits I met my wife, and as a result of that I got on loan to the RAN, and then I decided I'd like to transfer, and I did. I was fortunate enough to be able to. Well, that, after a short welcome in Colombo, we went round to Trincomalee. I think this will go round, don't you? Well, Trincomalee is shown there. It is a very wonderful harbour, very big and very beautiful, almost completely landlocked, with good deep water, and a number of bays, somewhat on the style of Sydney, although the sweep of the main bay is considerably wider. It must, at some time, again in the future, I believe, figure as an important naval base, so long as navies exist. And that had been the naval base until they were moved off against their will to Kilindini. And we spent many, many weeks in and out of that place. And we found lying at anchor a great conglomeration of ships, such as I, who had loved the Navy from the age of seven and followed it in the wonder book of the world, wonder book of the Navy and so on, found great battleships, many destroyers and cruisers, many more than I'd seen before. And it was a very large fleet, as you'll discover. I won't bore you every time with reading the list, but it was a large fleet by all except American standards. American groupings of ships, certainly in the Pacific, exceeded it. But I don't know that this size was exceeded even in the North Atlantic at the time of searching for the Bismarck. Well, we were given, you know, on certain terms, a very stiff program of working up, particularly bombardment, working up, anti-aircraft shooting, shooting at battle practice targets and splash targets and things of that sort. And soon we took to sea and met the US aircraft carrier Saratoga. Now, at this time, the Americans in the Pacific were starting. We're starting to get back on the offensive, or get onto the offensive, and it was hoped that some of their operations might be assisted by some diversionary operations in the Eastern Fleet area. And so for the first time, I think, these were starting to be coordinated in any meaningful way. The only aircraft carrier, sorry about that, I don't think I really can stand up like that, that we had was the Illustrious. And it was thought that she was not powerful enough, and nor were her crews well trained enough to give a very good account of that fleet in its first offensive operation against the Japanese. And so she was sent as an old hand to strengthen the fleet and show the Illustrious a thing or two. And indeed, she did. It was most evident to us, greenhorns though we were, that the deck operations of the Saratoga, the capacity of her aircraft, the speed with which they assembled, and the very number of them, greatly outshone the Illustrious. And in that way that callow youths have, we scratched our heads and wondered how that could be, since we had been brought up in the great tradition that the Royal Navy was best at everything. She was a very popular ship for the short time she was with the fleet. Well, the most popular station was one which became known as Station Ice Cream, which was immediately astern of the Saratoga, and received its name from the occasion when a returning aeroplane was unable to land on the deck because of some foul-up, some crash on deck, and so they were told to ditch. So the crew of three ditched their aeroplane alongside the Saratoga, just to show them that they didn't like it very much, and the three crew got out and stood on the wing, and the cruiser Cumberland, immediately astern, hauled out of line, stopped and picked them up. Well, she got a hell of a rocket from the Admiral for stopping, and the cruiser should never have stopped. If we were going to risk anybody stopping at the danger of submarines, then it should only be a destroyer. But the Cumberland didn't mind, because when they got into harbour, they got a bucket of ice cream over from the Saratoga. And that fully compensated them from the anger of the Admiral. And there was considerable vying for the position after that. But indeed, they didn't lose many, and not in that way. Well, by the 19th of April, this first operation was ready to take place. And I don't know whether to dare ruin it again. I think I ought to, because, do you mind, do you think we might take her down, perhaps leave it down, and I'll try to manage mostly with this. Because this place that I'm about to mention became a sort of magnet, it seemed to me, in the affairs of that fleet, and that was the island of Sabang, which is just to the north of the tip of Sumatra, is separated by a strait of 2 miles, perhaps, and is a sort of volcanic, ex-volcanic island. And so it was decided that the first operation should be against that point, which indeed is in a strategic situation if you are contemplating a foray into the Straits of Malacca, which I suppose someone was contemplating. Well, the fleet that sailed consisted of the battleship Queen Elizabeth, the battleship Valiant, the sister ship of the Queen Elizabeth, the French battleship, the Richelieu, which, having gone through the trauma of the Dakar attack by the British, had joined the anti-Axis forces, and I believe served fairly happily and certainly very well. Then 4 county or colony class or ship class 6-inch cruisers, the Dutch ship Tromp, a very strong destroyer, we'd call her perhaps a light cruiser. She'd have been about the strength of those C-class or D-class British cruisers. And the Napier, Nizam, Nepal and Quiberon, Australian destroyers, 6 other destroyers, and that was in that group. In the other group, there was the battle cruiser Renown, which was the sister ship of the Hood and the Repulse, both of which were lying at the bottom of the sea, feeding the bones of their sailors to the fish. And she was a very beautiful ship to see. The Illustrious was 17 Barracuda torpedo aircraft and 13 Corsairs, for a total of 30. And the Saratoga, of about the same size, with an 11 Avenger torpedo bombers, 18 Dauntless dive bombers, and 24 Hellcats, for a total of 53. So you see what I mean when we used to look with some amazement at what the Americans could do. Then the cruiser London, which I was in, and 6 destroyers, including 3 US destroyers, and the submarine tactician, which was stationed as a sea air rescue vessel off the port of Sabang, and as a result of the attack, 12 US planes were hit. I don't know why the British planes weren't hit. They were perhaps went in first or what, I don't know. One US plane was shot down, but the pilot was rescued by the submarine. So there was a loss of no lives in that attack. There was considerable damage inflicted upon the Japanese. But we had gone into this operation with considerable trepidation. We had heard of the attacks made on the US fleet, US and Australian ships in the Pacific. We fully expected that we could, be within an hour or two, be battling waves of kamikaze bombers or other Japanese reaction. Well, 3 Japanese planes took off to retaliate on the fleet, and they were shot down 60 miles away by the Saratoga's aircraft, and that was all we saw of the Japanese. So that was quite a surprise to us, but I believe was the first straw in a wind which indeed blew increasingly strongly as time went on, and which indicated that the Japanese, like the Americans, like everybody else, had centered their attention upon the Pacific and the defense of their homeland. Even then, it had become quite apparent to the Japanese that they had to concentrate on that area. We, however, went on concentrating on this area. Not that it wasn't fun, it was. It went on being fun for quite some time. And the next operation was one which I thought particularly impressive and indeed enjoyable. On the 30th of April, a force consisting of the cruiser London and Suffolk, because of their lovely long legs, their ability to stay at sea a long time, and 6 tankers, 1 storeship and 1 warship, sailed from Trincomalee to Exmouth Gulf in northwest Australia. And on the way, we played deck hockey and we went to action stations morning and evening. We saw, on one occasion, we went to action stations in the middle of the day because of this strange silver balloon, which you could see with the naked eye. It was obviously a secret weapon of some sort, but it turned out to be the planet Venus. But you could see it standing in the bright sunshine of a tropical day and see the planet Venus with your naked eye, like a silver hundreds and thousands. In due course, we arrived, somewhat bored by that time, at Exmouth Gulf. On the way, we had, of course, observed radio silence, but for some reason best known to the communicators, we had been ordered on a particular day to break radio silence. I never have understood it, but this was so, and the captain of the ship had to send a signal. And of course it had to be in cipher, and no one must know who it was from. One of the storeship was called the Bacchus, and as in every convoy, and I'm sure Commodore Knight will back it up, there's always one ship that is a problem because it just can't keep up, or it keeps breaking down, or it says it's doing 9 knots and it's only doing 8, and that was dear old Bacchus. And so we waited in the cipher office with fairly bated breath for the message that the captain would send, wondering what he'd tell them about this great endeavour we were on, and we received the signal to cipher up, "This god of wine may have his tot, but he is the slowest of the lot." That was really it. And presumably the message was of sufficient length. I suppose it was confirmation, in fact, to our people that we hadn't all been sunk and written off. We arrived in Exmouth Gulf, and there waiting in Exmouth Gulf was HMAS Adelaide. And if you look at the book, you'll find that Adelaide had had a rather dull war. She'd been mostly on the Australia station, and she'd been sent up to Exmouth Gulf to be guardship. And we had a small fraternisation with them, and I knew why we were going, because those of us in Cipher Watch knew a lot about what was about to happen. But most people didn't know why we were there, although everyone guessed it must be something pretty big. And the Adelaide's jaw dropped lower and lower as they saw us come in. And the following morning, early in the morning, arrived the rest of the fleet, which was the same old lot of the QE Valiant, Richelieu, Roulin, 8 destroyers, and then the aircraft carrier force, illustrious Saratoga, and 6 destroyers. And Adelaide must have wondered, you know, whether they'd been dreaming. The fleet fueled, that evening sailed northwards, and the following day on the 17th struck the naval base of Surabaya and the oil refineries there. And the Adelaide, poor old Adelaide, very downhearted, was left to look after the tankers and so on. One US plane was shot down, and that meant 2 planes shot down in those 2 quite hefty operations. And thereafter, the Saratoga and 3 US destroyers were detached, and they sailed down to Fremantle and went back to the Pacific. And I don't know, and the history books don't say, whether that may have been because the Americans who had lent her had evaluated that there wasn't much of real import going to happen in the Indian Ocean. That may not be so. Anyway, we drew the short or long straw again, and everyone else refueled and shot back as fast as they could to Trincomalee, and we struggled back with the Bacchus, and of course this time it was uphill and it seemed to go on forever. In fact, Admiral Royal, who was a naval aviation specialist, reported to the Advisory War Council in Canberra on the operation, and his view was that it could easily have been done by aircraft from Darwin. In fact, the aircraft from Darwin had struck the same targets on the following night, and this could have achieved the same effect without a pretty dangerous concentration of valuable ships in an area which at least was open to Japanese land-based air. And I think that might be a pretty true comment, and one made not with the value of hindsight, but at the time. Well, this started to make us wonder a bit, worms though we might be, as to really whether we were contributing all that much to a war which, just a few odd thousand miles away, was becoming a very bitter and difficult struggle as US Marines, Australian soldiers, and ships of both sides tried to fight their way up through the island chain towards Japan. However, it went on, and probably the most offensive, spirited action was again at Sabang, and we didn't take part in this. I can't remember why. I think that probably we were in Bombay having a small refit of some sort. The illustrious, and this time the victorious, had been sent out from UK along with the Trump and destroyers, attacked Sabang, and this time the Trump and destroyers, particularly the Quick Match, with on board our dear departed friend Otto Humphrey Beecher, where he won a DSC, entered the harbour and plastered whatever they could see with 1,000 rounds about of 5-inch or 4.7-inch ammunition. And that was the last operation planned and executed by Admiral Somerville, who was then relieved by Bruce Fraser. And we all thought that was bloody awful, that Somerville, who was such a get-up-and-go admiral and who had, by his directness and his ability to jump on board and tell us what he thought of us, won our respect, that he should be, just at the time as we seemed to be coming to really full strength, be relieved and sent to Washington as the advisor there. And I believe that when all the letters and signals are taken apart, we'll find that he and Mountbatten, who was his junior by many places in the Navy list, didn't get on all that well. Admiral Mountbatten, of course, was up at Candy, supreme commander of the whole theatre, and there were various views about that, not necessarily known to us down where the worms live. But it was very apparent to us that there was a noticeable decline in the offensive intention of the operations which we were called upon to perform. And we came to regard them as training exercises for other ships that would phase through our fleet and go on to become the British Pacific Fleet. And that indeed is what happened. The carriers such as Illustrious and Indomitable and Victorious did just that. They came, did a quick, short operation, apparently fairly meaningless, against an opposition which was not in the least bit interested, and then went on to the BPF. So perhaps that was our contribution to the war, because the Japanese certainly weren't suffering very much from us, or if they were, they didn't think it important enough to do anything about. Most of these operations appear in the history book as being timed to coincide with something more important on the other side. For instance, we perhaps did a thing which we came, I'm afraid, in our fleet and my ship to rather laugh at. It was timed to coincide with the landings in Leyte Gulf. And some of you maybe have been there, were there, or know about it. And that was a considerable operation and considerably contested. And our diversion, which was supposed to somehow take the Japanese eye off the ball, was the bombardment of Carnicobar. And Carnicobar is an island between the Andamans and the Nicobar Islands, and was a rather beautiful tropical island. It was stated to have an airfield, and I believe it may have done. We bombarded it for 2 or 3 days, and I well remember that attached to us were the destroyers Norman and Quiberon. Norman was commanded by Commander A.E. Buchanan, and Quiberon by Commander Arch Harrington. The Norman was with the London and was bombarding along with us closer inshore. The orders were exceedingly strict that we were at all times to make certain that we did not bombard the native village or native fishing boats, because Britain wanted to be loved again when they came back to the Nicobars. Well, the Norman had expended as much as it could think of on anything it could see, and there, drawn up on the beach, were some tempting, palpable native fishing boats, which the Norman started to engage in spirited fashion, and received a signal from the Admiral, "Stop firing at native fishing boats." Norman, meanwhile, going bang, 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 sent a signal back saying, "Submit enemy landing craft." They managed to have a bit of fun before they were made to desist under pain of court-martial, I think. But that was the sort of operation it was, I'm afraid, and the Admiral in command of it, who by that time was in our lot, had been earlier Admiral Hooky Walker, of considerable renown and the same sort of man that Somerville was. I think Admiral Patterson was the same sort of admiral I am, instantly forgettable. He's not mentioned in most of the history books. We knew him after this action as Nicobar Patterson. It's claimed that our ability to stay in that area so long demonstrated our mastery of the sea. Well, I believe we'd had that mastery for some considerable time. If you find this speech rather iconoclastic and denigrating some of the events of the past, I think we ought to remember that that indeed is the memory of most people in the war, that not everything that was done was ace good or directed in the correct way. And at times, one knows, of course, from the First World War, where it went on to a much worse extent, many, many hundreds of thousands of lives were thrown away on useless operations. We, at least, didn't throw lives away. An event occurred, and it was stated, by the way, that this Nicobar action, it was stated in Roskill, that although this hadn't achieved much in regard to Leyte, and the Japanese had concentrated on the white billiard ball and not the red one, which we were, and therefore we'd really failed in this great endeavour, however, had been a great boost to the morale of the fleet. And it really wasn't. That may be what was in the reports of proceedings and the explanations of why it was all a good thing, but I believe our morale went down because we couldn't see that we were doing anything. And do remember, you know, we had no inkling of the atomic bomb. This was 1944. People were talking in terms of 3 or 4 years more at war. And here were we stuffing about, doing nothing, boxing at shadows, we thought. Anyway, all is not gloom because an event came along on the 8th of August which lifted our morale immensely. In those days, the anti-fouling paints and procedures, cathodic protection and so forth, which now have been a part of our life, and extend the life, the in-between docking period of ships to perhaps 18 months, and greatly contributed to by the research laboratory here and the dockyard laboratory. But they didn't exist, and in tropical waters you grew a lot of weed very quickly, and a lot of weed slowed you down a lot, and it used a lot of fuel, and this was terribly important in this area. We didn't have the sort of fleet train the Americans had, and we didn't refuel at sea in those days except very occasionally. And so every now and then your beard on the ship's side was adjudged to be in need of a haircut, and you were sent round from Trinco to Palumbo to go into dry dock and have a bottom scrape and repaint, and this enabled you to go to the Gallface Hotel. It enabled some of the officers to take out wrens from the wrennery. It enabled worms to queue up at the wrennery, see whether they could get a wren, which they never could. It enabled one to bargain for fake sapphires and even real sapphires with the tradesmen. Anyway, it was different. And sometimes one got up to Bombay. And just before this time, to our great gloom, and I'm sure to the great strategic benefit of the fleet, had steamed or been towed into Trincomalee a dirty great floating dock. And it was a magnificent great thing. The little one out here in the dockyard is just nothing. It was vast. And this meant that suddenly we got ourselves on a program, and all haircuts and shaves would in future be done in Trinco. And you'd have to almost sabotage the ship to get out. Well, into the floating dock went first of all a colony class cruiser, I think it was the Newfoundland, and they came out happily and sugared off to Australia and on to the BPF. And then went in the Adamant, which was a fairly large submarine depot ship, and they got done and painted up, and they went south to look after submarines operating out of Fremantle. And then in went the Valiant. And they started to pump her out, and they got her up, and Valiant was out of the water, but the dock wasn't, or not completely. And came the end of the working day, and they shrugged their shoulders and said, we'd better come back tomorrow. So they came, went home. And at 8 o'clock that evening, one of the sections of the dock, it was built in three sections, one of the sections collapsed on the port side, and the water rushed in on that side. The cranes rushed down the incline that then came and fell into the dock, or off the dock. The dock went down by the stern, listing to port, with the Valiant sitting in it. And at one time, there was signal, all boats, and a friend of mine driving a motor cutter from the London drove his boat over the quarterdeck of the Valiant, which was underwater. And it was a real crisis. And it's understood, and everyone was jolly secretive about it afterwards, I can tell you, that the ship had reached almost that critical angle where it would just go over. They still had warmth in the 16 boilers or 32 boilers, whatever it was, enough to have a bit of steam, and they went ahead on the props, shook themselves off the blocks or whatever happened, chomped up what was left of the dock. The dock then sank below them and they floated free. But with three ruined propellers and one which could only just turn over. And that was a very serious thing. Commodore Knight shaking his head at such a disaster. Sir, I ask you to believe that as far as the worms were concerned, this was the best thing that could ever have happened. I'm telling you how it really was. Except for the fact that, talk about oil pollution, we spill 5 gallons of diesel off the ship here at Garden Island, everyone goes ape. We had floating for 6 weeks on Trinco Harbour, black oil that thick, and no hands to bathe, no nothing. Anyway, that was a boost to our morale, and we never did hear what happened, of course. Some of us had theories that it had been built in Bombay, and what could you expect from the racist jokes even then. Having since, lived through or with things like the Westgate Bridge, I believe that some chap left a naught off one of the calculations somewhere in the line. But it might be of interest to engineers to find out. I don't know where it is in the Admiralty. It never has disclosed the findings of a board of inquiry in its life, I don't think. Well, I think that gives you a worm's eye view of the main things that I remember from that time. We indeed went on doing operations of this sort, and each one seemed to have less and less relevance to what was really going on. Gradually, our numbers, though remaining the same, represented a much weaker fleet as aircraft carriers of the type of the illustrious went to the British Pacific Fleet, and we ended up with Woolworth carriers which had been released from the North Atlantic ASW patrol. But it was still told to us that this was great gung-ho stuff and we were terribly important, and this was so hard for us to believe. Anyway, by August we were assembled in Trincomalee, and the word was, this is it. We are about to invade Malaya. And while we were girding up our loins and thinking at long last we are about to strike a real blow, they dropped the atomic bomb and suddenly it was all over. And all the carriers expended their pyrotechnics in Trincomalee Harbour in 30 minutes. The worms in the London ended up in the commander's report because we fired 2 star shell. From our 4-inch guns, which was considered a great danger, and no doubt it was. Well, did I learn anything? Yes, indeed, I did. I learned a lot. I enjoyed it a lot. And part of the learning, I suppose, was being disillusioned and learning to question everything you heard. I learned that great admirals and great concepts are rather few, that you can dissipate enthusiasm by not being entirely honest, because just rushing about bombarding the bloody Nicobars fooled no one, not in our area anyway. either our intelligence was rotten or our intelligence up here was bad if we really believed the Japanese would take their eye off the ball where it was all happening. To some degree, we degenerated, I think, into a PR exercise. And it didn't fool the enemy and it didn't fool us. I think its value really was in that it did become a training ground for a much stiffer competition. At times one feels that the cynical comment that the Americans made that the SEAC command, the Southeast Asia command of Mountbatten, was really the Save England's Asian Colonies command, since we were clearly to be there on the spot to make sure that Malaya remained a part of the British Empire. But that, indeed, may have been a good aim to have had at the time. One thing that really stands out with me is that the fleet that I was in, and whether it did great things or not, it certainly was big. And at that time, it was inconceivable that a fleet of that size and a nation which could produce it would ever withdraw or fade away. And I think that there's a lesson which we can learn and must learn. However solid the land on which we stand or the ships which we have stand, they're only as permanent as we and our will is prepared to make them. And that perhaps is a message which is relevant for tonight. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.